Hello and welcome to Savor, production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we have an episode for you about Merlot.
Yes. And as always with these, drink responsibly.
Yes.
Okay. But I got to start out immediately with a Seinfeld reference. Okay. So, I don't know if I've ever really explained this, but the reason I know Seinfeld so well is I had four channels, one of them being TBS here in Atlanta. Well, Georgia, growing up.
Okay.
And on TBS, they played Seinfeld all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the few things that I could get consistently, even though sometimes I had to touch the TV and raise my hand. I don't know if that actually worked, but it felt like it did.
Yeah, it felt like it was helping. You felt like you were participating.
Yes.
Sure.
So I was obviously not old enough to drink Merlot in the 90s when these episodes were coming out. But I did, for better or for worse, take in these messages of what adulting or adult life looks. And I know everyone's screaming, that's worse. But yeah, I was like, okay. I even asked my mom, and this wasn't just Seinfeld's fault, but like sitcoms in general. I was like, is the only way to meet people is like you meet them in a bar and then you dump them a week later. And she was like, no. anyway, there is an episode where Kramer and his friend Mickey are going on a double date and they don't know who the two women involved in this scenario are interested in.
Oh, okay.
They kind of like forgot. And so their plan is to show up at the restaurant early.
Okay.
And then the two women will sit across. Whoever they choose to sit across will determine.
Sure.
Yes. But the women were there before they got there.
Oh, no. Uh-huh.
Anyway, there's a really awkward conversation that ensues. That's just like, I like your shirt. Oh, well, I have the same shirt. Well, I also like the shirt. Like, nothing is getting decided. And the waiter comes, and they're, like, kind of waffling on what they should drink. And one of the women says something like, what about Merlot? The other person says, like, oh, I love Merlot. I do, too. And then Kramer says, I live for Merlot. And then the waiter says, we're out of Merlot. And Kramer, of course, falls out of his seat. And, yeah, that's how it goes. Uh-huh. But that's one of my very first, like, oh, Merlot is popular. It's something people seem to like, which is really funny.
Okay.
Given the turn that happens that we're going to talk about. In this kind of discourse around Merlot in the United States specifically. But I just remember being young and watching that and thinking Merlot must be so good and sophisticated and like everyone loves it.
Oh, wow. I was not keyed into characters like alcohol choices in media until much later, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I was really... I don't know. I was just trying so hard to figure out what it was going to look like whenever I eventually left my home, which is funny because I know we've discussed this too, but I made a lot of ordering mistakes at bars just because I didn't know what else to order. Like, I know what a screwdriver is, so I'll order a screwdriver. And yes, it is like 11 p.m. at night, but that's the only drink that I know or, like, you know, things like that. But I do like Merlot.
Me too.
Yeah. I'm more of a, there are certain wines that I'll lean more towards, but I'm more of like a flavor profile than a specific grape normally. I'm more like, is it bold and like dry? I'll like it probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are generally my preference. But I don't know. I mean, you know, it's different moods, different foods, different whatever it is. And so.
Ooh, I like different moods, different foods. I like that. That could become a shirt or something. Something. So we've done past episodes that are related to this, perhaps tangentially, but sangria recently, rosé, and our very first episode on sparkling wine.
We were
little baby food stuff.
Very, very first episode was about sparkling. So
yeah. And to this day, every time I open a bottle of sparkling wine, I think of that because I was so scared to do it until you walked me through the process, Lauren.
I mean, it makes a big noise, and I know how easily startled you are, but but it can just get a dish towel and wiggle. It's fine.
And it has been fine thus far. Aww. But I love that every time I do it, I think of it. I did have a bottle open by itself on me recently.
Oh, heck. Oof.
Yeah, that was something.
Was it when you were preparing to drink it anyway, or was it just out of nowhere?
Yes.
Okay, well,
it's... Yes, and the foil was off. Mm-hmm. I believe the wire cage was off as well, but it...
Just boop?
It went.
Huh.
It definitely booped. A loud boop. But all right.
Yeah.
We're not talking about sparkling wine today.
Not today.
Let's get to our question. Merlot. What is it?
Well, Merlot is a type of grape that's used to make wines, both single varietals and blends. And wine grapes, stepping back a little bit, are a type of fruit that grow on woody vines. Merlot grapes in particular develop in these large, loose clusters of big grapes that are blue-black in color when they're mature. They like temperate climates that don't get too cold in the winter. And these grapes are primarily used to create red wines. That is, wines that are pressed with the skins on so that they're kind of burgundy color when they're done wining. Although rosés and whites made from this varietal are not unheard of. Super quick winemaking rundown. So what you do is you grow some grapes, you pick them, you press them, and then collect the juice, which is also called the must. You add some friendly yeast to that, and then let the yeast eat the sugars in the must and poop alcohol and flavor. Yeast food. And then you typically let the wine age for a bit in barrels or bottles. But that's how it works. Merlot is one of the most prominent types of wine grapes from the Bordeaux growing region of France, which surrounds this river system in the southwest corner of the country. Compared with other grapes used to make red wines there and in similar climates, Merlot grapes tend to have thinner skins and ripen a little bit easier and a little bit earlier, which tends to mean that these grapes produce wines that contain less acids and less tannin than, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon, which is also from Bordeaux. Merlot wines thus tend to taste a little fruity and soft, like not sweet, but not very bitter either. Three frequent tasting notes that you hear when people are talking about Merlots are velvet, plums, and spice. Yeah. But of course, grapes are a product of nature. They use sunlight and water and soil to grow. And so small differences in all of those things, along with temperatures and other factors like pruning and pests, all of that can produce slightly different grapes, which produce slightly different wines. And there are two base categories of Merlot grapes being turned into wines, a cool climate and warm climate. Cool climate Merlots are considered the classic type. They're the ones grown in places like France, northern Italy, and Chile. They tend to taste a little savory and earthy and like a purple fruit-like. They're a little bit softer. Warm climate Merlots are sometimes called New World Merlots, even though, yes, Chile is in the Americas. Anyway, these are grown in places like California, Argentina, and Australia, and they tend to taste a little spicier, a little bit chocolatey, and more like red fruit-like, perhaps, than purple fruit-like. They're a little bit stronger. They're perhaps closer to a Cabernet Sauvignon than a traditional Merlot.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. In the world of wine, Merlots are considered often a less challenging wine, both on the production end. They're considered to be good for adding to wine blends because they can mellow stronger wines out. And also on the consumer end, in that they're easy to pair with foods, they're not too harsh, and that's good for people who are still developing their palate for wine. They're considered to pair well with dishes that contain a lot of savory or umami flavors, roasted meats and fish, mushrooms, stews, tomato-based sauces, cheeses, stuff like that. But, of course, the best wine to pair with anything is a wine that you like.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. So true. Mm-hmm. It reminds me, when we first started, and I was determined to do, like, pairings of everything, and then... That quickly fell off the wayside.
Yeah, it's just like, this is not a science. This is not even an art. That's just like, I don't know.
You like it?
Do you like cool. it? Do that.
Yes. Well, what about the nutrition?
Drink responsibly. Woo. Yeah.
Yes. we do have some numbers for you.
Oh, we do.
According to the International Organization of Vine and Wine, Merlot is the most widely planted grape in the Bordeaux region of France. As of 2004, estimates put it at the third most grown wine grape in the world. And at the time, that number was only going up.
Yeah, the three top producers are France, the United States, and Italy. But, right, it's grown just all over the world.
Yes. And according to some sources, Merlot is America's second favorite red wine behind Cabernet Sauvignon.
Apparently, I was reading that buying single varietals instead of blends is, like, more an American thing than...
Really?
...than in most other places. Perhaps just a Bordeaux thing. I read that in Bordeaux, blends are preferred. And the same article was explaining that that California wines can label themselves as, like, whatever varietal as long as they contain 75% or more of that varietal.
Oh.
Which makes me suspect that blends are more common in American wines, or Californian wines anyway, than we consumers think. So,
oh, that's interesting. Because that does come up in the history as well. And I thought that was kind of, it made me take notice of why did California, it seems, be like, you know what? We're just sticking with this one grape.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Well, I don't know.
Welp. Well, we are going to discuss that in the history section.
We are. But first, we are going to get into a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
Back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. Bordeaux has been a wine-producing region for about 2,000 years, started up by the Romans in the way back.
Yes, but Merlot is actually relatively new compared to these other grapes, which, of course, could be a matter of what was getting recorded, as we always say. Despite that, its relative newness, anyway. The history on this one is a bit spotty.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Depending on the source, Merlot may have first appeared in the written record in France's Bordeaux region in 1784 when an official in that area claimed that the wine made from these grapes was superior. A winemaker from the region may have officially used it in a Bordeaux blend around then as well. From what I can understand, this is mostly going off a label that we're assuming, but that kind of confuses me because the name wasn't being used until later.
Mysteries, histories.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Others put the first mention of Merlot even later in the 19th century when the name was first coined in the written record. And I didn't dig into this too deeply, but the popular stories about the name are it comes from the kind of a French word for blackbird, and that being either because of the color was very dark and close mm-hmm. to a blackbird's color, or that the blackbird liked this grape.
That is what I've read as well. I received no further clarity.
Yes, no further clarity. But certainly by then, the grape was being widely harvested and used to make wine in France. Growers appreciated how well it blended with one of the region's most popular wine grape varieties, Cabernet Sauvignon. And the softness that it often lent to resulting wines. They really liked it as this blending
mm-hmm.
grape.
Yeah.
The grape was first recorded in Venice, Italy in 1855. It was introduced to Switzerland via Bordeaux around the same time. And records from a Swiss region mentioned Merlot between 1905 and 1910. Merlot made it to California in the mid-1800s, where many wine growers opted to make wines that were 100% Merlot, yes. Which I thought was interesting that mm-hmm. they were like, this is it.
Yeah.
Sticking with this one. France's Merlot grapes were almost entirely wiped out after a severe freeze in the 1950s. Growers attempted to replant Merlot grapes to replenish their stock as quickly as possible, but a lot of these grapes were destroyed by rot the next year.
Oh, no.
Yeah, several similar things happened in the following years to the point that the French government banned the planting of Merlot grapes in 1970 as a way to mitigate and prevent further financial and physical loss. The ban didn't last long, though. It was lifted in 1975 due to the growing popularity of Merlot around the world.
Yeah. Meanwhile, over in California, wine grapes in general saw a huge boom in plantings in the 1970s and then particularly picked up in the late 80s. And Merlot, more particularly. Merlot was the second most planted grape there from 1987 through 1997.
And Washington State, they are also involved in this. Washington State's Merlot production helped bring global attention to their wine industry in the 1980s. Americans' taste for Merlot and red wine in general saw a boost in the 1990s, in part because of a 60 Minutes report on red wine's potential health benefits, and perhaps specifically a chemical red wine contains called resveratrol. And I hope I'm somewhere in the ballpark of how that's supposed to be pronounced. There were other things at play in the growing popularity of Merlot in this country and of red wine in general. The trendy Mediterranean diet at the time, that it had this generally softer, fruitier profile that was more, you know, approachable, as they say. Mm-hmm. And that it was pretty easy to pronounce, which I've done before. Sometimes I'm looking at a menu at a bunch of wines and I'm like, I know how to say this one. As long as it's not exorbitantly expensive, that's probably the one I'll go with.
I do a lot of pointing at menu items.
Yes. You can also point. Never forget.
Never forget. You can always point. And most of the time, I mean, I don't know. Like, I suppose it depends server to server and situation to situation. But I feel like most of the time, if you're like, oh, man, I'm excited about this. I don't know how to say words. Like no one's going to really judge you for it.
Oh, of course not. But I do totally, like, multiple publications mentioned this easy to pronounce part.
Yeah.
And I
sympathize. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That Seinfeld episode came out in the 90s. Uh-huh. At one point, the Merlot market was growing about 20% per year.
Who?
I know. In that same decade, Chilean officials realized that Chilean Merlots were widely mislabeled, made instead with the Carmenere grape. When it was discovered this wasn't the only instance of wine mislabeling in the country, owners of the Chilean winery Domaine Paul Bruno invited experts to inspect their grapes to make sure everything was correct. But this is another instance of I would have had no idea. I don't know. And also that grape is closely related to Merlot.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm excited to talk about this. Okay. In 2004, the critically acclaimed movie Sideways came out, which had a much debated impact on the Merlot industry. If you haven't seen it, which I haven't.
Oh, really? Huh.
No, but I'm excited to talk about this because it did impact me nonetheless. It stars Paul Giamatti as an unsuccessful and unhappy teacher who never made it as a writer, who goes on a weekend trip with a friend to California wine country. It's based on the book by the same name by Rex Pickett.
And the film is directed by Alexander Payne.
Yes. And Giamatti's character loves wine. Except for Merlot, which he is apparently vocal about.
The
opinions he has of it. Much preferring Pinot Noir over it. And after this movie came out, U.S. sales of Pinot Noir rose by about 16%, while sales of Merlot dropped by about 2%, causing a decrease in price. Although the U.S. wine industry overall experienced growth in sales, and the U.K. saw a similar trend.
Hmm.
And people have legitimately dug into the impact this movie had on Merlot in America. Some people say that people who saw this just switched out Merlot for Pinot Noir. Others say thanks to overproliferation and saturation of the market when it comes to Merlot, Merlot sales were already declining, so we're reading too much into this. Still others say that the movie actually did deter a whole generation from Merlot. Some producers argued that this was actually a good thing for Merlot because it caused less serious producers of Merlot and their resulting lower quality Merlots to leave the market. So that led to the overall quality rising when it came to Merlot, and that those acres that were going to this like lower quality Merlot could go to something else or producers who were more serious about Merlot.
Yeah.
Yes. But as I said, I had not seen it, but I heard about all of this. and when it came out. And I know for me at the time, it made me feel basic, like Merlot was basic.
Huh.
And that it was, I had no taste. Like that meant I actually didn't really like wine, that this was like the lowest common denominator of wine. And that's why I liked it.
Oh, man. See, this has always mystified me a tiny bit because, like, Giamatti's character in this film is such a jerk. Like, he's so clearly not a role model for any type of, like, life experience. Like, why would anyone listen to what this dude said? He's so mean about it. He's like, I think the quote is something along the lines of like, if anyone orders a Merlot, I'm leaving. I'm not drinking a f***ing Merlot.
Whoa.
And, yeah. And so, I took it as like a joke, like, you know, like just this other arbitrary thing on top of all of the other arbitrary things that he has chosen to be, like, just like way up his own butt about. And so, I don't know. I mean, the wine that he drinks at the end of the film is a Merlot blend. It's this thing that he's been so excited about. He's been like waiting to try anyway. So, yeah. I didn't really drink wine when I saw this film, which was right around when it came out. So I didn't really have an opinion about Merlot or any other type of wine grape. And I guess I internalized it a little bit too. I was like, oh, Merlot must be silly and Pinot Noir must be good, I guess. But then I drank some Merlots and I was like, oh, I like this. Huh. So I don't know. Yeah. It's as we said, the best, and as many other people say that have a lot more experience in wine than either of us combined, probably.
Yes.
The best wine is the wine that you like. So, you know, if you like Merlot, buy it. I mean, heck, bite because that character hated it. I don't know.
Oh, man. This is a different podcast, but this I actually have been thinking about this a lot and kind of the glorification of the asshole.
Yeah, yeah.
The damage it's done and how we take, like, in this instance, kind of a angry jerk white man's he says it's bad, it must be bad. Like, I just trust it. Like, oh, I hadn't even seen it. And I was like, okay.
You're like, oh, yep, sure.
That must be true. I have been thinking about that a lot lately, actually. And just, like, who gets to decide these things? And
right, yeah.
It's ridiculous. Drink Merlot if you like to drink Merlot.
Yeah.
Yes. Don't drink it if you don't want to. It's cool. So, researchers from University of California at Davis used a DNA analysis to determine that the Merlot grape originated from Cabernet Franc and Magdalene Noir de Chantre grape varieties in 2009.
Yes, unrelated to the film Sideways and or Paul Giamatti, yes. As far as I'm aware. Yeah.
I'm sure it was spurred on, probably. Like, it did cause quite a thing.
It did. But this was super cool to see, like, right, like genetically speaking, where Merlot had come from, since there had been so little written about it in the history. And research is ongoing, not necessarily into that, but in lots of related Merlot-y areas. Over the past 5 or 10 years, there have been just a lot of fancy chemistry and agricultural research done with wines and winemaking, trying to, like, tease out what compounds are responsible for particular flavors and textures in wine. By textures, I mean, like, the levels and types of astringency and stuff. Like, what makes a wine feel dry in your mouth versus, like sharply dry versus kind of softly dry. It's all different chemical compounds. It's super interesting. Lots of this has been playing with, like, really specific growing conditions, like soil and gravel content in that soil and water and shade, seeing what effects all of these things have on the grapes and then seeing what effects that has on wines.
That is cool.
I can never resist talking about this. When it comes up, one bit of research that was done in 2020, a French startup called Space Cargo Unlimited, sent a bunch of Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot plants in the form of little bits of budwood that can be kept in, like, cold stasis. They sent them up to the ISS, the International Space Station. The plants stayed there for 10 months, then came back to Earth and have been revived and planted. And the resulting fruit is going to be studied for any changes that exposure to microgravity and space-bound radiation might have caused. The researchers working with the vines hope to, like, sell these space grape varietals in the future.
Oh, my goodness. And you know people would buy it.
Oh, yeah.
Space wine. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Part of the same experiment did send 12 bottles of finished wine from Chateau Petrus up as well, specifically Petrus 2000, vintage from the year 2000. And Petrus is a Bordeaux house that uses mostly, if not all, Merlot grapes in their wines. There was an initial tasting of this space wine in March of 2021 that bore comments that the space wine seemed 2 to 3 years more matured than control samples of the same vintage that were kept on Earth.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, this is something else I've been thinking about a lot lately, and that's how time works differently in space.
Oh.
I would feel like it'd be less mature. What do I know?
Well, I mean, you know, it's not just the time factor, but all that space radiation,
sure,
the microgravity, who knows? Who knows?
I gotta take this into account. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah, could have just mucked with the flavor compounds without actually having the time dilation or contraction effect. Yeah.
What are we talking about again, Merlot?
Yeah, we're a food show. Hi. Anyway, this hypothetically, this whole ISS wine thing isn't just a publicity stunt, although it's definitely a publicity stunt. But it's again about different stresses that can happen to vines and wines, and seeing what happens when those products and biological samples are under stress. So, yeah.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Just send everything up to space and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, this has been a fun one. We've talked about space and pop culture and jerks. Very, very interesting indeed.
It is. Thank you, Merlot. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Merlot. I live for Merlot. That quote is ingrained in my head. Well, I guess that's what we have to say about Merlot for now.
It is. We do have some listener mail for you.
We do, but first we have one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with listener.
Hey.
Lovely glass of Merlot.
Yeah.
Nice, soft. Approachable.
Yeah. I feel like you were like raising it up to the sunlight and kind of checking the color for a second there, maybe doing a swirl. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Beautiful. In my cosplay closet. I can still envision being in California wine country.
Oh.
Yes. One day, Lauren.
Mm-hmm.
Amberly wrote, I loved your recent episode on za'atar. I am half Lebanese, and therefore Lebanese cuisine makes up a lot of my personal food culture. We always have a container of our family's za'atar blend in our kitchen, equal parts oregano and thyme, a slightly smaller amount of sumac, salt to taste, and then we pour equal parts olive oil and neutral vegetable oil over top and mix it. Mm. I tried to get a more exact recipe from my mom, but this was the best I got. I live in Canada, and we don't have good access to the actual za'atar herb. As I have an anaphylactic allergy to sesame seeds, we omit that from our blend. So I am curious how sunflower seeds might work as a substitute, though they would likely need to be chopped into smaller pieces.
Hmm.
I was also surprised that za'atar usually refers to a wild oregano, since I always thought it referred to a wild thyme. which I guess it also does. In my opinion, culture and food have such strong ties, but living with severe food allergies, it limits the foods I can safely eat. Although a lot of Lebanese cuisine uses sesame seeds, we have found ways to adapt recipes to accommodate my allergies, such as finding ways to make hummus without tahini. But this has only happened because it is a part of my family's culture. I am sad that I haven't been able to try a lot of Asian foods and cuisines because so much of it features sesame or another one of my allergens, and I have no way to understand how to adapt the recipes and preserve the integrity of the dish.
Yeah, this is a difficult one I don't have any food allergies that I'm aware of, but I do have several intolerances that it's really better for everybody involved if I avoid. And so sometimes I'll look at a recipe and I'll go like, oh, I think I just can't eat that. I think I just I don't know how to solve for this equation. Like if I take out this element, like how do I, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is true. Like that's one of our big things on this show, right? Is that link between culture and food. And I'm very happy to hear like in your family, you found ways around it and that you're still like looking for like, ooh, what could work for the sesame seed in this case. And, but you know, that being said, it does suck. Like there's a lot of foods that you just can't have.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I do feel like another seed or nut would probably transfer well into a lot of those types of recipes that use either sesame oil or, I mean, if it's just sesame seeds as a dusting, like, eh. But yeah. just like a, cause the base note in there is kind of like sweet and nutty and creamy. And so anything with that kind of, any fat with that kind of flavor profile might work for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And let us know if you come across anything like that. I still have not been able to find za'atar. I'm determined to do it. But now, potentially could make it.
Ooh,
I see.
Yes.
Yes, 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 yes.
Oh, goodness. Salvador wrote, I'm from northern Mexico, and corn dogs are common in fairs and as snacks in children's parties. In Spanish, we call them banderillas, meaning little flags, probably because of the stick and the colors of mustard, mayo, and ketchup. Being closer to the U.S. means we get some influence on our food and culture from this proximity, so I'm not sure if banderillas are common in all of Mexico or just the northern states. But here's a big difference. Mexican banderillas are made using a wheat batter, specifically pancake batter, so you get a soft, fluffy, kind of sweet covering on your hot dog that somehow works really well with the mustard and ketchup. I would have expected that being Mexico, corn would have been a natural choice, but for some historical chance, we have wheat dogs instead. I enjoy banderillas every now and then, but I'm curious to try corn dogs and see how they compare to what I grew up eating.
Ooh.
Right? Yeah. Oh, see. Yeah. See, as much as I like kind of came out hard against corn dogs, and like specifically what I dislike about them is that I've always had them sweet, like the coating being sweet.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, hot dog and a pancake? I want to try a hot dog and a pancake. I would eat a hot dog and a pancake right now.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I hope that you do get to try corn dog and compare. Because that also, in that episode, that's kind of been my hesitation, is this sweetness. And also, I think, like I said, old oil.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like that taste. But yeah, I could see a hot dog and a pancake situation. If I was in the right mood, I could see that being good. I have really, really, really enjoyed how many people have written in about corn dogs. It's like my heart is so warm that so many of you have thoughts about corn dogs. Because we do too.
Yeah, yeah. It's apparently one of those things that just brings humanity together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I recently had some friends who were so excited that they encountered corn dogs in the wild. Oh. And I was like, so happy for them. Well, thanks to both of those listeners for writing to us. If you would like to write to us, we would, as always, love to hear from you. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod. And we do hope to hear from you. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.